So we hope that you'll find a seat at a table with some folks who are new to you to stimulate conversation across those lines. We're so pleased to have today, at this first plenary session, Dr. Shannon Ross. Shannon and I met in 2001 at the inaugural Duke Youth Academy, both working there, and that's where Shannon came to love youth ministry and has worked with youth and young adults ever since then. He now serves as the director of the Institute of Youth Ministry at Princeton, which exists to resource, train, and support folks who work with young people in the church. His articles have appeared in several publications, and he's the author of a book called Gifts, Glittering, and Poisoned, and that was out last year from Cascade. So I would like to introduce you to another Shannon Ross who is in the room, and if she'll wave her hand. Shannon Ross is the wife of Shannon Ross, who is lecturing for us today, which, of course, has caused some good stories and some confusion over the years. They have two-year-old twins, so they're very busy people, and also have a nine-year-old son, Noah. And the Shannon who is lecturing for us today enjoys reading the St. John's Bible with Noah when they have that time to do that together. And Shannon has vast amounts of free time, as I'm sure you can guess, and he enjoys boating on the Delaware River during that time. He has been a great resource and an inspiration to me in the last several years as we've talked about forming youth and congregations' roles in that and theological youth initiatives. And he's very engaging and inspiring, so I hope you will join me in welcoming Shannon Ross today.
Thank you. I was just... is this on test? I'm going to put on this lapel mic so that I can wander around a little bit. I was just telling Jenny that y'all are for a really good treat, great treat, because I'm a really good dancer. No, I'm not. What we are going to talk about today, what I'm asked to talk to you about, is youth culture, which is a kind of interesting thing, right? Like, what do these words mean? And so I thought we could start this first session together by just doing a little word association. When you hear the words youth culture, what words come to mind?
The Beatles.
What else comes to mind? Youth culture.
What's that?
Music.
Texting.
Selfie.
Selfie.
Sex.
Rebellion. What else? Babes. Oh, okay. All right, what else?
High school.
Anybody else want to toss one into the ring?
Countercultural.
Sports.
Some games.
So, it occurred to me the other day that it's the year 2015. And you're thinking, this guy's a genius. But here's the thing. 2,000 years is a really long time. How are you supposed to get a young person who lives their life through a smartphone to want to live their life through a gospel that was birthed 2,000 years ago in a world and in a context that was so radically different? How are you supposed to get a young person who scrolls through a Facebook feed or a Twitter feed or an Instagram feed constantly to want to scroll through Matthew, Mark, Luke, John? Books that were written in languages that we don't even speak, right? It's a really remarkable problem. And when people think about youth culture, it's generally with the sense that young people live in a world all their own, right? And it's it's challenge enough to get that world to somehow engage the adult world. Never mind to get that world to be engaged by the world that produced the gospel. And so often, we end up spending a tremendous amount of time thinking strategically about how can we get young people interested in all things Christian. And most youth ministry strategy is focused on those kinds of questions. Because our theme for our time together is raising Daniel and Danielle in battle, right? And of course, that names a time when God's people were living, as we've heard, under empire and in a hostile culture. Of course, though that was true also of the early Christians. Have you ever imagined or thought or asked yourself, what would it mean for an early Christian parent to raise a teenager in 30 or 40 or 50, 80? So, a few years ago, actually 2010, I was in Philadelphia. And how many of you have been to Philadelphia? Okay, so you've been, anybody in the National Cons, or the Independence Hall? Liberty Bell? Anybody make their way to the National Constitution Center? The National Constitution Center is just a stone's throw away from Independence Hall, where, of course, the Constitution was signed. It's this hub of history where the birth of the United States took place. And the job of the National Constitution Center is to educate Americans on what it meant to be an American, what the history, the American history, and the progress of American culture. And as I saw the National Constitution Center for the first time, something rather extraordinary hit me. They had this 8,000 square foot exhibit that had taken 3 years to put together, that had taken many, many millions of dollars, and that was set there for an entire year to educate millions of Americans who would come. And the theme of this exhibit was America and Ancient Rome. The purpose of the exhibit was to help Americans understand that when the Founding Fathers began the United States, they were in many ways trying to recreate the Roman Republic. And I thought, wow, this is interesting. Maybe the world that birthed Christianity and the world that we live in aren't so different after all. Now, as you would make your way through this exhibit, there was a whole section dedicated to Roman cultural and social life. And there in the center of that part of the exhibit was a model and pictures of the Roman Colosseum. How many of you have been to Rome? How many of you have seen the Colosseum? I have not. So some of you have a better sense of this, even than I do. And I realize, of course, that some of you can't see the slides very well, so I'm going to describe what's up here, and also the wonderful light is shining in, so don't worry if you can't see too much. You won't be missing too much. So, but here's the thing about the Roman Colosseum. It was the central hub of what the Romans called the spectacular, the Spectacula Romana, the spectacle entertainments of Rome. And these are the things that you normally associate with the Colosseum. Gladiator combat, feast hunts, ritual executions. Really, really bloody, horrible things happen inside the Colosseum. But what we have to also recognize is that this was entertainment for them. And it was not just in Rome, but throughout the empire. North Africa, for example, it was even more powerful there than it was at Rome. Also throughout all of the provinces, like Judea, where the Romans were engaged with the Jews. So one of the important things to understand about this is that spectacle wasn't just entertainment. It was integral, these spectacle entertainments and the power of spectacle, was integral to their politics, to their economy, to the expansion of the empire and their military conquests. It was essential to their religion as well as to their entertainment. And so if you took spectacle, all the things that the Colosseum represents, if you took the power of spectacle out of Roman culture, all of those things would change, be dramatically different, or fall completely. Which is in turn kind of interesting because in recent years, many scholars, including theologians, philosophers, cultural theorists, sociologists, have recognized that spectacle, the power of spectacle, is integral to our own culture. Right? And I probably don't have to work too hard to convince you of this. Spectacle, for those of you who can't see, this is a picture of Barack Obama at the Democratic National Convention. Spectacle is pretty important to politics. If you are a politician hoping to be elected to office, especially on a national stage, you have to master the power of spectacle, don't you? Right? And we're about to go through this all over again with the next presidential campaigns, and we're all about to be subjected to the spectacle of political campaign. It's integral to our economy. For those of you who can't see, this is a picture of Times Square. Anybody been to Times Square recently? So Times Square is kind of an epicenter of our economy, a kind of snapshot. And it is a powerful spectacle. Spectacle in the economy is essential because it's how we learn to want, right? Spectacles are important for marketers because through the use of powerful spectacles, it cultivates the desire. Oh, I didn't know I wanted that, but now I do. You know what Steve Jobs said? Steve Jobs, founder of Apple. People don't know what they want until I show it to them. Right? Spectacle is a powerful tool in the marketer's hands to get us to want the things that we want. In entertainment, of course, this is a picture of the Kardashians. I'm going to apologize right now for that. But entertainment, right? Reality television is all spectacle all the time. Right? The news media is also a kind of entertainment. And the news media have to get us to pay attention to the stories. And so all of the stories end up coming across as a kind of spectacle. And it's not just Fox News. It's also CNN, it's ABC, it's CBS, right? They're all in competition for eyeballs, and spectacle is the way that they get the views. It's increasingly important to our religious life. And as many of you who are pastors know, there is a sense of sort of megachurch worship, and the spectacle plays a powerful role in that, right? The other interesting thing about spectacle is that it makes all of these different things, politics, the economy, entertainment, it makes them kind of come together, right? So the lines that divide them end up sort of graying a bit. I mean, you have to admit, there are a few things more entertaining than watching the spectacle that is Donald Trump run for political office. Right? I mean, and I really, part of me really hopes he wins, because then the late night shows are just going to be fantastic. We'll have to clean up the total disaster that he will leave, but you know what I'm saying. But it's true, right? Entertainment, politics, all of these things kind of come together. It's the power of spectacle in our culture, but spectacle is perhaps nowhere more powerful than in what we typically call youth culture. And why is... Well, there are many reasons, but one, of course, is that youth are perhaps more susceptible to the power of spectacle. If you're a marketer and your primary demographic is 16-year-olds, then sex and the spectacle of sex can go a long way for you, right? Young people are inundated with images that tell them who to be, how to be, what to value, what they should look like, what their bodies must look like if they are to be worth anything. The spectacle generates this self-consciousness, and it generates this kind of self-perception, this constant correspondence between who am I and what is the culture want me to be, and the intermediary between those is this powerful spectacle. So what I want to suggest to you is that there is a real connection between the world in which the gospel came to be, the world in which Jesus lived, ancient Rome, and our own, and that common denominator we might call in one word, the power of spectacle. So what early Christians had to deal with when it came to Rome's spectacle entertainments, and what we have to deal with, while the actual spectacles may be different, we don't have gladiator fights nowadays, right? But we do have really powerful spectacles, and they are forming us and forming our kids in powerful ways. And whenever I talk with parents about youth culture, this is kind of where the conversation starts. Because as the child gets older and older, suddenly the parent begins to realize that there's this really powerful influence. It's not just that the child is sort of self-differentiating and all the natural things that come with being an adolescent. It's that there are these powerful cultural forces forming the child in ways that we don't want to have. And how do you deal with it? And one powerful word to describe that is the power of spectacle. So let me tell you a little bit more about the story of Rome's spectacle entertainment so that we can begin to bridge this gap a little bit. How did it come to be that Roman culture was so dominated by the power of spectacle? Well, if you were a politician in the early Roman Republic, you had a bit of a problem. Couldn't just start a Twitter campaign or a media campaign in order to get your platform out there, in order to get your name out there, and then get votes. So somebody had the genius idea at some point that they would make slaves fight each other. And that if they held that kind of entertainment, people would en masse come and want to watch it. And then when they had all the people gathered there, that would be an opportune time to say, I'm so-and-so, I am running for office, you should vote for me, you should know who I am important, all these things, right? And that, we don't know exactly when all of that began to happen, but we know that the first set of gladiator combats began in about 260, 265 or so BC. And then over time, it became, you know, once one person does it, then the next has to do it, and the next, and the next. And of course, everybody has to outdo who came before them. And so over time, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And as that began to be, that phenomenon began to take on a life of its own, then, of course, the populace began to expect this of their political leaders. This is a sense, for those of you who can see this, I'm going to read it, so if you can't read it, don't worry. But this gives you a sense of the progression and the power of spectacle in Roman culture. In 267 or so, we have three pairs of gladiators fighting. In 174 BC, we have an example of 37 pairs of gladiators fighting. This is all in a single instance, right? In 60 BC, we have 320 pairs of gladiators fighting. This is exponential increase, right? So you imagine then how many people are coming to watch, and you can see how this would begin to affect the society. In 20 BC, 700 pairs of gladiators fighting. By the time we get to the end of the first century, we have an example in 98 AD of 11,000 animals being part of it. Killed as part of a spectacle entertainment, and 10,000 gladiators being killed over the course of 123 consecutive days. Right? That's like a third of the year. Right? If you're living in a culture where that's called entertainment, where that's called the norm, you're dealing with a pretty corrosive and powerful phenomenon. Now, I mentioned that this began with politicians and the need to garner attention. The person who was more adept than anyone at using spectacle for his political gain was Augustus. Emperor Augustus. The emperor who was in power when Jesus was born. Right? Now, the reason Emperor Augustus became Emperor Augustus, his name was Octavian before, The reason it's Emperor Augustus and not Mark Antony is because while Mark Antony, if you remember some of your Roman history, had power of the military, Augustus recognized the power of the people, the power of being popular. So while he didn't have near the money as his rival or any of the military power that his rival had, he figured out that if he could make the people love him, if he could give them spectacle entertainments in mass, that force alone would bring him to be the most powerful man in the Western world, the emperor of the Roman Empire. And that all happened just a few decades before Jesus was born. And once Augustus comes into power, he recognizes that other people could also use the power of spectacle, right? And so he provides, for the first time in Roman history, an administration. And the administration included things like what kinds of buildings spectacles could happen in, who was able to throw spectacle entertainments, and who wasn't. And the other thing that he did was he set down a schedule. So whenever a spectacle entertainment would happen, he would say, beast hunts would happen in the morning. Gladiator combat would happen in the afternoon. And ritual executions would happen in midday. They're called, I forget what they're called, but they would happen sort of in as a break, right? So you can see how this would become kind of necessary if you're going to hold spectacle entertainments for a course of 100 days or more, right? People would actually want a schedule. So this is a little mind-boggling to think about. In some ways, it kind of still feels like, wow, how could they call that entertainment, right? But it was incredibly popular and incredibly addictive to watch two people fight to the death, or to watch exotic animals like elephants and leopards from countries and places you've never been be brought into the Colosseum and to watch those animals fight one another. And so the Colosseum holds, estimates vary, but somewhere between 50 and 70,000 people would pack in and watch this happen for day after day after day. So here's one more interesting piece,
and then we'll make a bit of a shift that I think you'll find helpful.
As I mentioned, spectacles were really tied to Roman religion, Roman pagan religion, the worship of all the gods, the pantheon. And so, before any spectacle entertainment would happen, there would be a parade, a march, from the temple of a given god or goddess through the streets of Rome, and that would end at the Colosseum or whatever the particular venue was. And the parade was called the Pompa. So if you can imagine a god or goddess being carried up high, Roman soldiers marching. Except you don't really have to imagine that much if you were watching the Super Bowl halftime show a couple of years ago and you saw Madonna being carried. This is an image of Madonna being carried. She's dressed as a Greco-Roman goddess, and she's being carried by many, many men who are dressed up as Roman soldiers. That's what the Pompa was. It was this parade going from the temple into the Colosseum. And if there's any sort of event or building that is close to the Colosseum, wouldn't it be a football stadium? Wouldn't it be something like the Super Bowl where we watch men sort of go at it with one another? That was in 2013. In 2014, the Super Bowl halftime show was provided by none other than Beyonce. Anybody remember that one? You see that one? So here we have Beyonce in what is probably the most important or powerful American spectacle. And this is how National Public Radio described Beyonce's performance. To keep in mind, then again, that the spectacle had a really religious import, and this
This is what they said. Beyoncé strutted into the very center of America's biggest television spectacle. If Beyoncé nailed this one, she would be a god, a savior of pop, an icon to worship, the ultimate. She believes in spectacle and in being singular and in uplifting those around her by her inimitable example. I didn't pay National Public Radio to write that. But I kind of came unglued when I saw it. I thought, man, maybe 2,000 years isn't such a long time after all. Right? So if we go back for just a moment to thinking about the growth, right, of all of these spectacle entertainments and the impact that it would have on society. Especially if you're going to be killing 11,000 animals and 10,000 gladiators over the course of 100 days, you have a little bit of a logistical problem. What do you do with all the bodies? How do you dispose of 20,000 human and animal bodies in a course of 100 days without it becoming an absolute disaster? Well, they ate the animals. See, the spectacle entertainments were these incredibly powerful opportunities for the politicians and the Roman elite to really make the people love them. And so they would feed the people. They'd have this lavish feast. So they'd kill the animals and then they would eat. Ever been to a baseball game where they have those t-shirt cannons? In Rome, they had those. They would stand at the bottom of the Colosseum or some other venue and they would shoot things up into the crowds. They would often shoot tokens, or they would drop tokens from the sky, and these tokens were things that you could then use to go and get all kinds of goods, and you could use to get food. And so the spectacle entertainments were literally and quite figuratively consumer events. Now that's not an anachronism, because one of Rome's most noted historians, Dio, in the first century, the end of the first, beginning of the second century, surveyed what was happening to his culture. And to describe his own culture, use the word analiskein, the Greek word analiskein. Anybody know what it means? It means consume. Paul Plass, a Roman historian, picked up on this and describes in great detail how Roman culture in the first and second centuries was both society acceptable and a mass consumer society. Now that provides a couple points of contact for us, doesn't it? So you think early Christians were trying to raise their children and be the church in a mass consumer society. And the consumption looked somewhat different than it does for us. But nevertheless, there are many points of similarity. And one more quote, and I promise this is worth it. At the end of the first century, Juvenal, one of Rome's prominent figures, surveyed what was happening to his culture and lamented this way: "The Roman people, who once handed out military command, high civil office, legions, everything, now anxiously hope for just two things: bread and spectacle." In the original, it's bread and circuses. Circuses is just another synonym for spectacle. Okay, let's take a quick break here and shift gears. How many of you are familiar with The Hunger Games? How many have read the books or seen the movies?
Oh, way more than I thought.
It's kind of interesting, don't you think, that some of the characters in the Hunger Games are named Caesar, right? Octavia. Brutus, I think, is another one of the names, right? Julius, I think, is one of the names. Augustus is one of the names. These characters are named for actual people who lived in the first centuries B.C. and A.D. And they are named that for a reason. What's the name of the country in the Hunger Games? What's the name of the country? Do you remember?
Pan Am. Why is it called Pan Am? What's Pan Am mean?
It means bread, right?
It's the Hunger Games. What are they hungry for? They're hungry for
the bread and the spectacle. In the third book of the Hunger Games series, Mockingjay, there's this wonderful dialogue between two of the main characters. And if you can't see it, don't worry. I'm going to read it here. Two of the characters are talking about where the Hunger Games comes from. It's a saying from thousands of years ago, written in a language called Latin, about a place called Rome, explains. Pan Am, at circuses, translates into bread and circuses, or spectacle, bread and spectacle. The writer was saying that in return for full bellies and entertainment, his people had given up their political responsibilities and therefore their power. I think about the capital, the excess of food, and the ultimate entertainment, the Hunger Games. So that's what the districts are for, to provide the bread and the circuses. In other words, the Hunger Games is a futurized version, a contemporized version of Rome in the first, second centuries. With characters that are named for actual people who lived in those times. Which kind of makes my first question seem a little silly, doesn't it? Like, if the question is, how in the world could we get young people to think that the world that birthed the gospel has anything to do with our time today? They're already convinced of that. The Hunger Games is an adolescent novel series that became a blockbuster movie series. Young people are flocking to this story by the millions. They don't have a hard time thinking that somehow this describes our life and our culture. What time do we
have, Jenny?
We're going till 4:15, right? Okay. So let me stop there, and
this is a lot that I guess I know. And so let's stop there and see what thoughts, comments, I'm even open to smart remarks, you might have, and see if any of this is resonating with you.
What do you think?
I mean, I think it's a seed of suspicion. Mm-hmm. But then it's what do you do with that, or how do you provide an alternative?
Yeah, there seems to be... There, it's interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
Repeat the question.
Yes, I'll repeat the question. So the comment was, or question was, do you think that the Hunger Games is a seed of suspicion, right, about the power of the spectacle? Or is the Hunger Games story more about sort of the dominance that it plays in our culture? Is that basically getting it right? And I asked, you know, which do you think it is? And you said, you think it's a seed of suspicion. Like, there's like, this is a kind of resistance to the spectacle, this narrative, the Hunger Games. What else? Other? Let me ask you this. When you all were, with those of you who've seen the Hunger Games or read the books, did you have a sense of the historical background of the story? Anybody?
A couple people?
Okay. Right, right. This is the great piece. The spectacle, the power of the spectacle is it turns everything into a commodity, right? And so this gets to your point that in some ways, I think you're exactly right. It's really phenomenal that we have millions of young people who are keyed into a narrative that is about resisting the power of spectacle, and of Roman spectacle in particular, right? On the other hand, that same spectacle has come along and commodified that narrative. And so then it just kind of, anything that might get used kind of just falls out, right?
I think I agree with you. I also think it's interesting that what people get keyed into is
the spectacle of the games. People don't talk about, you know, rebelling from the system that is oppressing the people. It's all about the games itself. And even, like, I think people would be lying if they didn't get an adrenaline rush from that part of the story.
Sure.
Because it's thrilling. It's exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
It's awful. But that's what people, I think, get lost.
Yeah, that's a great point. So there's this tension on the one hand of, like, wanting to identify with the main characters who are trying to fight back against the power of the spectacle, and on the other hand, watching the spectacle happen itself and being like one of the spectators in the Colosseum, right? So, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think there's the cheapening of activism as well. The idea that you could be really enthusiastic about Hunger Games is kind of what's at the heart of that. One of my favorite words is slacktivism, right? Slacker activism, where I can just hashtag something and feel like I'm participating or I'm doing something, but it requires nothing from me. But I feel, you know, like I can watch a 12-minute video and then be like, you know, Pony 2012.
Right.
And that, now I'm a political activist because I watched a 12-minute video. Or because I, read The Hunger Games and I get conceptually, you know, what's being communicated and I'm going to express my enthusiasm for it. And now it's checked off my list, right?
Right.
It hasn't cost me.
Right.
You know, it just reminds me of one of Gandhi's 12 rules of social sins, which is worship without cost or worship without sacrifice. You know, and yeah. Anyway, there's a lot of thought there.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how and the spectacle and the power of consumer culture takes even resistance. And turns it into a yeah, not tomorrow. And then, and yet we feel good about it, right?
The next question's over here.
Yeah.
One of the things that you've kind of sparked for me is the connection in between consumption and violence, and how these Colosseums were all about violence. And the Colosseums that were built later on included just outside of the main doors that going in, the doors are called the vomitorium, and,
uh-huh.
and the they built these rooms in later ones which were basically big sinks that people would go to throw up into.
Uh-huh.
Because they see the violence on the field and they get physically sick, so they have to go throw up.
Uh-huh.
And so it's also a way of creating the very hunger then that the empire is going to satiate us with.
Right.
So if you had more comments on violence and spectacle, I'd love to hear them now or some other time.
I mean, by the way, is that what Lady Gaga
So you both pointed out this sort of great tension between, on the one hand, being drawn to this thing and yet being repulsed by it. And that's one experience, right? And that this is kind of how spectacle works. I mean, you can probably remember the first time you saw a really, really violent or really gory movie. And it probably didn't stop you from going and seeing another one. But you also probably had a kind of sick feeling in your stomach. And this is how it was for the Romans, too. And what happened is that, like us, they created a division in their own minds and in their own culture. And so, on the one hand, believe it or not, Romans would try to protect their children from violence that was outside the spectacle. So if you were walking down the street and you saw a dead body or you saw something really graphic or grotesque, that, you know, a mother would take her child and be like, oh, don't look at that, and go a different way. But where that was happening could be like one street away from the Colosseum where literally people were being killed. So if it happened in the Colosseum, then that was fine and morally acceptable. If it was outside of that social space, then it was something completely different. How do we do this? With violent video games, for example. Right? We should, the things that are enacted in violent video games, and are there any other kinds at this point? Right? Are absolutely grotesque to us socially. You would never do that in real life. But if you're in the video game, and you're an avatar, it's completely, totally acceptable. And our young people are really, really into this. Our young people are very adept at creating this division for themselves.
right?
Yep.
There's an additional complexity in that people want to observe spectacle, but if it's too far removed, then it becomes problematic for them. And I'm thinking there's a sense that there's I need to be somehow connected to these people. There's a scene in one of Shakespeare's underappreciated tragedies, Coriolanus, where the general is running for consul and he goes in front of the people, the tribunes, and he has to show how humble he is by showing off his battle wounds and fancy bread. So it's there's the violence and there's the consumer good, and he can't bring himself to be humble enough to do this, and that leads to the ultimate tragedy in the play. Whereas by the time you get to the emperors who are gods, then they become they at least deign to come down to the people and distribute things. So there's always a sense somehow that I could be connected to these people, that when we watch sports, we want the up close and personal, we want to see the other side, or all the reality shows where somebody, you know, does, you know, America's Got Talent, you know, this unknown person who's suddenly a spectacular star. There's a sense that it's so completely otherworldly, but there's somehow that I'm connected to those people as well.
Yeah. That makes me think about the fact that gladiators who were made to fight each other were slaves, right? They had no choice in the matter. And they were trained by these people called Lanistae, who had these schools. And there's a whole economy around this. It's an incredibly powerful economy. And so these people are slaves. They're being forced to do this. But they're also celebrities, right? Why are they celebrities? Precisely because of some of the dynamics you're talking about. Because the populace identifies with them. And so you would get behind one gladiator and cheer for him, or another and cheer for him. Right? And so there was this need to have a kind of proximity on the one hand, but not too close. Right? You wouldn't want to actually know that gladiator, because if he dies, then you would suffer loss. And instead, you just need to be able to move on to the next glad. So there's this interesting tension there between proximity and distance. Yep.
I don't know that this plays into the Hunger Games, but I'd be interested if it does. There seems to be a relationship between boredom and spectacle.
Uh-huh.
And when I think of examples of boredom, I don't always think of are the interest in spectacle. I don't always think of youth. I think of my grandmother, who spent her days watching soap operas because her life was so tedious. Mm-hmm. She watched that many spectacle.
Right.
And she and my aunt would have a conversation in the evening about what Susan Lucci had done that day. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was in some ways a horribly impoverished kind of way of relating to the world. But it was what she had available. So, the Latin term is tedium, right?
Yeah, right.
Kind of meaningless, not mind-numbing labor.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that that we need to think through how boredom feeds into this.
Yeah. You know, John Milbank describes the society of the spectacle as the de-intensification of being, which is another, like, that you lose your being. How does spectacle do that? It's actually really key to the way marketing, spectacle and marketing works, right? Like, if you're sort of brought into this desire, like, oh, I really wish, I really want this thing. I really want this iPad. You know, I didn't even know that I needed an iPad, and then all of a sudden they existed, and suddenly I didn't want. And I didn't know how that happened. And then you finally get the thing, if you had this experience, you finally get the thing, and then you just kind of feel empty, right? Which I think is related to the dynamic you're naming. And this is why the shopping mall can exist, right? Because you go there, and the shopping mall is a very powerful symbolic order of spectacle,
And you don't have to need anything to go to the shopping mall, because the shopping mall will cultivate it inside of you. Once you get there, you'll discover that you do want things and you want these. And then you come, you have all these bags, and you come home, you put it all on the bed, and then you go for like a week or 2 weeks and you feel empty again. What the spectacle does is it creates insatiable desire. It doesn't actually satisfy us. It cultivates an insatiable hunger in us. Right? This is what markers are really, really good at. Well, the ones that are good at their jobs. This is why it plays so well, right? It can't actually satiate us. And it was the same thing in Rome. You saw the progression, right? There was never a point at which there were enough gladiators or enough animals killed. The hunger just grew more and more and more, hence the hunger games. Somebody had it.
And this goes on what Michael was saying, that, and it's part of the counter issue that I think we probably can work on. The games to a great extent were shaped as a way to keep everybody busy.
Yeah.
You have way too many unemployed people. They're way too hungry physically. There are other problems inside. What we need to do is entertain. And that intensity, as you say, kept increasing. So much of spectacle is about keeping people from being reflective, either personally or in conversation with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we keep that from happening? Same thing about the soap operas. Let's keep meaningless stuff, spectacle going on, so that they don't really engage a meaningful conversation that, in fact, then might hold the Caesars to a different job description.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's anything that you're going to have as a counter, is how do we shape ourselves to be reflective personally in conversation,
yeah,
so that that's not devouring all our time and we're not consuming, as you say, the meaningless commodities.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you. All right, let's shift gears for a second. We'll keep coming back to this, but I want us to think for a second about how this new context, as we've discussed it, might give you some insights into the ministry of Jesus, and particularly the relationship between Jesus and Pilate and Jesus' crucifixion. And what it is that Jesus is about when he goes to Jerusalem fully intending to be crucified. Now, Pontius Pilate is a governor, right, of a province, a Roman province. And not a particularly good province to be governor of. Nobody wanted to be there for very long. One of the main reasons is because he had to govern these really unruly people called the Jews. And for God only knows what reasons, as far as the Romans were concerned, these Jews insist on only worshiping one deity, which to the Romans, right, which is inconceivable. And so to be in Pilate's position is not a particularly fun job. And he wasn't in the job for very long. But like any Roman governor, Pilate was responsible for providing sexual entertainment. And so in Caesarea, just north of Jerusalem, where Pilate lived, there was a large venue for doing this kind of thing. Any of you, if you're kind of interested in Pilate, Anne Rowe wrote this amazing biography called Pontius Pilate. And in that biography, she talks about how Pilate would have needed to go about the business of obtaining leopards and panthers and all other kinds of animals, exotic animals, bringing them to Caesarea and providing these spectacles for the populace. He would have needed to recruit Linistae to train gladiators. There would have been gladiator schools, right? So it's Pilate's job as governor. Now, remember that the spectacles include beast hunts, and they include gladiator fights, and they include many other things, but they also include ritual executions. This is part of the economy and ecology of the spectacle. Now, for those of you who can see this, I don't know how well you can see it. For those of you who can't, don't worry, I'm going to explain it in just a second. But what do you see? What's that look like to you? Yeah, so it's really hard to see because of the light. But doesn't it look an awful lot like Golgotha? Right, it's three crosses with the one cross higher up in the center, two crosses on the side, and
And if you were able to see it better, you'd actually see people gathered around the base of the cross. I mean, when you look at it, it just immediately evokes this image of Golgotha, but it's not an image of Golgotha. It's just a painting inside the Colosseum. Someone, at some point, just made a painting depicting what was happening in the Colosseum. And it's not at all surprising that it turns out that it looks a lot like Golgotha, because crucifixion was one of the main ritual executions that was part of the spectacle entertainment. In other words, crucifixion is spectacle. And so, this has some implications for how we think about Jesus' decision to go to Jerusalem and be crucified. He's fully intended on becoming the spectacle. He wants to be the spectacle. For Jesus, it's something of an opportunity, right? Now go back with me and remember the way that the gospel narratives sort of play this out. Each of them is a little bit different. But as you'll remember, the Jewish leaders had brought Jesus to Pilate and said, this person is someone who is challenging the authority of Rome, claims to be a king, you need to crucify. And Pilate didn't buy it, right? And so Pilate ships him off to Herod, and Herod does some things with him and ships him back to Pilate. And now Pilate's got this problem, and the Jewish leaders are just so insistent. Jesus guy must be crucified. And Pilate doesn't want to do it because he's enemies with the Jewish leaders, right? The last thing he wants to do is what they want him to do, and probably doesn't quite understand why it is that they're so obsessed with this guy. Because he can't really see any real reason to crucify him. So in this tug of war between Pilate and the Jewish leaders, the Pharisees, it says in Mark, finally came up with a way to force Pilate to do what they wanted him to do, to crucify Jesus. They go out and they stir up a crowd. Now remember, it's Passover. So the streets of Jerusalem are just absolutely full of people. And one of the things that we know is that the Jewish people were absolutely participants in, many of them, participants in spectacle entertainments. And that many of them would go to Pilate's spectacle entertainments in Caesarea. And the reason that we know this is because from the writings of Jewish rabbis, the rabbis were really concerned with the fact that their people were doing this thing. That their people had been sucked in to the spectacle, that they've been seduced by the power of the spectacle. So, in this case, with Jesus, the Pharisees go out and they stir up a crowd. And a crowd amasses outside of Pilate's residence. And they start shouting, crucify, crucify, crucify. Now, to a Roman politician's ears, that's incredibly powerful. Because remember, over time, the politicians have become, it was expected of politicians to provide these kinds of spectacle entertainments. And so now Pilate's got a problem. It's not just the Jewish leaders, it's this people. And they are calling for him to give a spectacle entertainment. Crucify Jesus. And so Pilate goes and he says, who do you want? Do you want Jesus or do you want Barabbas? Right? He's putting himself in the position of the gift giver. I will give you, you choose. This is really regular stuff that for Pilate. There's nothing particularly strange about this, which is also why Pilate thinks, well, we might as well get rid of these thieves at the same time. Right? One on his left, one on his right. So it's the people crying out for a spectacle entertainment. This is exactly the place Jesus plans on being in. Right? But think about what happened the night before at the Last Supper. What is it that Jesus does? He says to his disciples there in the gathered room, I am going to be crucified. I am going, hear that just a little bit differently. I am going to be a spectacle tomorrow. I am going to take the stage.
I will draw all people unto me. I will have their gaze on me. And when that happens, this is my body being broken for you. This is my blood being shed for you. Jesus is taking the power of the spectacle and he's turning it to his own purposes. He is taking the most horrible, awful thing and turning it into the best possible thing, the salvation of humankind. This bread will satiate the hunger that you have for bread and spectacle. This bread will satisfy the Hunger Games. Right? Jesus, then, it's a kind of remarkable thing to think about, that this horrible form of entertainment is what Jesus chooses, is a medium which Jesus chooses to give us salvation. Let me stop there and see if any of that is resonating.
So it seems like to me that there's some danger in this conclusion, and maybe it's not a conclusion, but it's a
right.
step on the way.
Right.
And there are two different things I can think of. One is that Jesus was not in the role of Pilate, who was putting on the spectacle, that he was a victim of the spectacle, and that he was, in a sense, a spectacle to end all spectacles.
Uh-huh.
And that when we think about what Christian parents were doing in the first century, is that they were bringing their, you know, they were entering a world in which they could very well become the victims of the spectacle, but not that they would be putting on the spectacle. And I, one of the challenges that, you know, that happens in the church is the church then later becomes the people that put on the spectacles instead of
victims. Yeah. So. Yeah, right. So Jesus isn't the agent of the spectacle, right? That's Pilate's job. And yet, and you really nicely, I think, pinpointed, like you said, the danger, right? Like, so would this mean that spectacle is something that the church should be actively trying to produce? Is spectacle a tool in our toolbox, or liturgical toolbox? We should start. And some people have decided yes to that question, right? And suddenly worship starts to feel like a concert, right? A rock concert kind of entertainment spectacle kind of thing. There's a sense in which, like, you kind of feel like, oh, that could work because we could get more people in the room. And then we start falling into the same trap. So I think you're right. It's not that Jesus is actively producing a spectacle. He's the victim of the spectacle. Here's what I think Jesus is doing, though. And that then what early Christians began to do in exactly his, following his model. Jesus sees in the spectacle a deep desire and longing for God, for himself, that has been twisted. So if this desire and longing for spectacle is a distorted desire for God, you want bread and spectacle, then Jesus comes and says, I will give you the bread that you really long for. And I will give you the spectacle that you really long for. And as it turns out, this is how early Christians, many of them, began to understand how Jesus became spectacle. For example, Augustine says it this way. Christ told us himself before he became a spectacle to be gaped at. He foretold it, and in prophetic language he declared beforehand what was going to happen, as if it already had. He said in the Psalms, there you have how he became a spectacle to be stared at, so that they have even counted his bones. He goes on to call it a spectacle even more plainly. They, however, looked at me closely and stared at me. Augustine, Quavaldeus, Chrysostom, Ignatius, Tertullian, all of these church fathers and many more recognized that Jesus was engaging Rome's spectacle entertainment. He was turning it on its head. That in fact, as Jesus said to Pilate, it is not you who have the power. He's acting freely. But he is seeing in the spectacle a deep longing and desire for God, however perverse, and turning that thing into something completely different. But the key I'd like us to focus on, and then we'll take a break. We're going to come back to this. Sort of the connection point for us. What if all of these spectacles that comprise youth culture, what if we began to see in those a deep longing for God? What if young people are drawn to spectacle in part because they are trying to find God? How then would that begin to shape how we think about and engage not just youth culture, but our culture of spectacle and consumption more generally? What if there are expressions in that of deep longing that we could begin to name and address? All right, what time do we have now? And when do we need to be done with the last session? 5:45. Okay, so we're going to take a 15-minute break now. Does that sound good?